Dr. David Kilcullen, US-based counterinsurgency analyst and military strategist, also the author of Blood Year, Islamic State and the Failures of the War on Terror. In your book, as the title suggests, you are critical of the Western allies' strategies for the war against terror in the Middle East. Do you believe that the Western coalition have not taken serious measures to end the war in Syria and Iraq?
I think the most important failure is the failure with respect to Syria. I mean, we've seen now 11 million people displaced. Half of the cities in Syria are destroyed. Half the people of Syria require, you know, they depend on international humanitarian assistance to survive. And really, the West has taken very little steps until quite recently to focus on ending the war, reducing humanitarian costs, and trying to stabilize the situation in Syria. And I think, in addition, we focused, to the extent that we have paid attention, we focused too narrowly on ISIS. At this point, the Assad regime has killed 9.5 times as many people as ISIS has. So we need to be thinking, I think, more broadly than just terrorism, to realizing that actually the danger that's afflicting people is much broader than that.
Right at the start of the spillover of IS into Iraq in 2014, they, as well as many analysts, believe that the map of the Middle East, as we know it, was forever changed and that the Sykes-Picot borders have been redrawn. Can Syria be kept as a whole for this war to end?
I think that both Syria and Iraq, it's very difficult to see how either of those countries could ever go back to where it was before the war. I think it's also difficult to see how countries like Jordan and Lebanon and even Israel will come out of this conflict without a very different set of circumstances that they have to face. So I think that in many ways, Iraq and Syria are like Humpty Dumpty. And rather than trying to put them back together again as they were before and try to make everything go back to, quote, normal. Instead of that, we need to be thinking now about how do we reduce civilian loss of life, how do we end the war as quickly as possible, and make it so that people feel safe enough to engage in a political discussion to resolve their differences, rather than trying to do that with car bombs and barrel bombs and helicopters.
On that note, how do you perceive the so-called ceasefire in Syria?
Well, it's still a little bit early to tell how it's working. There certainly has been some reduction in violence on the ground, but we've seen ongoing breaches of the ceasefire. And of course, it's important to remember that some really important groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS, Ara al-Sham, some other groups are not party to the ceasefire and are being continuously attacked. I also think it's worth pointing out that the Russians, the Iranian troops in Syria and the Assad regime are still attempting to encircle and cut off Syria's second city, Aleppo. And if that happens, that will create a humanitarian catastrophe that could potentially dwarf any benefits that we've seen from the ceasefire. That doesn't mean that it's all bad. I think at the very least, it's a step in the right direction toward making peace. But it's certainly civilians in Syria today are not much safer than they were 2 weeks ago.
Well, Turkey, one of the major allies in the fight against IS and part of the coalition, a powerful NATO member as well. How do we balance having US air power supporting Kurdish forces, for example, which are also being shelled by Turkey?
Yes, it's interesting. I've also noticed two things recently. One is that the Russian negotiators in the ceasefire are frequently referring to Kurdish forces as being on the side of the Assad regime in Syria, which I think most Kurds would reject. But that's certainly the way that Russia is seeking to portray it. The other thing that I'm noticing is if you read the Turkish press, and I'm sure many of your listeners do, we're seeing increasing rhetoric from some Turkish politicians that's comparing the Kurds today to the Armenians 100 years ago and saying that they're working with an enemy and that they're a subversive element. And of course, that creates really strong memories of bad times amongst both Kurds and Armenians in Turkey because of what happened 100 years ago. So I think that the way that I would summarize it is that the war in Syria is not only transforming the environment for Kurds in Syria and in Iraq, it's also creating a really strong destabilizing dynamic for Turkey on its southern border. And that is, I would argue, is even more threatening to Turkey than anything that ISIS might be doing.
You have said that ISIS sells oil to Turkey, which of course constitutes financial support for IS. And why is Turkey's support for IS in this manner is being ignored by the coalition that's fighting the Islamic State?
Well, I want to be clear. I didn't mean to imply that the Turkish government is buying oil from ISIS. We don't have evidence for that. We do have evidence that ISIS-controlled areas are smuggling oil out through Turkey, and it's possible that some local-level officials have done deals to allow that to happen. It's also worth pointing out that ISIS is selling electricity to the Syrian regime, even though it's fighting them, and is selling water and other commodities in the area that it controls. I think the important thing here that I'm trying to talk about in the book is two things. One, ISIS is trying to become a state. It's not just a terrorist organization. It does commit terrorist acts, but it's trying to be something more than just a terrorist group. It's trying to create a state-like entity in the region, and that's partly why it's engaging in these kinds of state-like behaviors. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that as far as Kurds are concerned in both Syria and Iraq, one of the realities now is that Turkey doesn't like ISIS, but it sees Iranian encroachment into Syria, and it sees the possibility for the emergence of an independent Kurdish state that might destabilize southern Turkey because of Turkey's own Kurdish population as being even more threatening than the existence of ISIS. So I don't think the right interpretation is to say, you know, the Turks are in favor of ISIS. The right interpretation is to say that there are many hard choices now for countries in the region. And for some, even though they might not like ISIS, there are even worse things out there for them to worry about.
SBS.
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 SBS Radio.
The Kurds, for example, have been said to be one of the most effective force fighting IS on the ground, and they are getting some support. But do you think the support that the West is providing the Kurds in this fight against IS is sufficient enough?
I think certainly in the case of Syria, more could be done to support the Kurds. And myself and many others have been calling for that level of support for a number of years now. There was a time, 2011 and 2012, where the Kurds were really the only ones that were successfully carving out a civilian-controlled state that they were running in what had been Syrian territory. And we didn't really put enough in. On the Iraqi side, I think we're looking at a slightly different scenario where so much money and weaponry and ammunition and equipment is coming into the KRG that it's actually destabilizing the relationship between the KDP and the PUK. And we're also seeing a circumstance where people are stockpiling ammunition and weapons, not necessarily to use against ISIS, but because they want to bolster their own position in relation to other people. So I think there's a danger that too much weaponry and ammunition and military equipment coming into Kurdistan, particularly since the political crisis last August after the end of Barzani's term, you know, may actually have a destabilizing effect.
How do you see the operation taking back Mosul from IS? That is, you know, it's been planned apparently. And do you think that that will be a big blow to IS in Iraq? And do you think that it will be successful?
It would certainly be a very significant blow to ISIS if it were to lose control of Mosul. As most of your listeners know, you know, Mosul is the second city of Iraq. It had a population of about 1.25 million before the capture by ISIS. It's been held now for more than 18 months by the group. And there is, in fact, an armed opposition against ISIS within Mosul that successfully assassinated the governor of West Mosul, the ISIS governor, recently, and has also mounted some operations within the city against ISIS. So there certainly is at least some opposition to the group in the city. And I think that as and when we're in a position to mount an attack to retake the city, it will be probably the decisive battle of the war. But I don't anticipate that operation happening anytime soon. It's been postponed again and again, and ISIS have been very successful in running what you might call a centrifugal strategy, where whenever they're attacked somewhere and they lose ground, they spin out additional fronts in different places as a way to prevent us from massing our forces against them.
So what do you think that ISIS's end game is, you know, simply to hold on to unregulated space and live in an eternal state of war?
No, I think that ISIS is a state-building entity. It's trying to construct a state, and then it's trying to expand that state by relatively conventional military conquest, both within Iraq, what is now Iraq and Syria, but also the wider region and through the wilayah structure in other countries to expand out into North Africa and to South Asia and Southeast Asia. So I think it's trying to build a state and to expand that state aggressively through conflict. And I think it's the side effect of the ISIS project, you know, the conflict and the displaced people and refugees, that's the most important damage that it's doing. The terrorism stuff is horrible, but it's only part of the broader threat from ISIS.
You have mentioned that the West and the coalition basically should look out for, you know, ISIS bubbling up in Afghanistan and Libya, for example, in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And how do you think ISIS can manage setting up forces and establishing an Islamic State in those two countries?
So I wrote the book last year and I finished writing it at the end of October. Mm. And when I wrote the book, that was a prediction. But we've since seen that happen in both countries. So significant parts of the far eastern part of Afghanistan and some parts of the south now have a very strong ISIS presence. ISIS doesn't control territory as such in Afghanistan, but it's certainly gaining ground. Many of the people that are fighting for ISIS in Afghanistan are originally from the Pakistani Taliban, and they were pushed into Afghanistan by a major Pakistani offensive last year following the murder of a number of children at a military high school. And that offensive, that which the Pakistanis had mounted, pushed ISIS fighters into Afghanistan, and they've created a safe haven for themselves there. Libya is different. In Libya, they are already controlling a port and a city and a significant part of the central part of Libya around the town of Sirte, which is, of course, Muammar Gaddafi's hometown. And they've carved out some territory basically in the grey area between the two warring factions that have been dividing Libya between them. So we already have a territorial entity loyal to ISIS in Libya. We're yet to see that fully develop in Afghanistan. But I think if we don't take strong action in Afghanistan now, it's quite likely that it will develop.
So how do you envision this ideology of ISIS for a global caliphate? And I know you're critical of Western strategy, but how can the West step up their game in order to get in the way of ISIS and for them to achieve such thing?
Well, I think there are three levels to ISIS. There's the central state-like entity that we've talked about in Iraq and Syria. There's the wilayat structure, which is now in 11 countries globally. And then there's what I call the international, which is the much larger but much less well-organized movement of individuals and small groups and cells that are carrying out subversion and propaganda and terrorism on behalf of the Islamic State. So I think for a strategy to be effective, it has to address each of those levels. And at the level of the central state, it's a straight-up military conflict. I mean, there's nothing particularly sophisticated about what needs to be done. We need to engage with our partners and bring sufficient firepower to bear to destroy the state-like elements of ISIS in the Middle East. At the wilayat level, it's much more about partnership and assistance to countries that are facing the threat. But I think we need to put a lot more effort into reform and into changing the way that governments interact with their people, because the reason that ISIS has gained ground is in part because governments haven't met their people's legitimate needs. And I think in all the countries that we've seen significant progress since 2001, the common denominator is real and genuine government reform, improvements in the way governments operate, and democratization. So I think we need to be working with partners to make sure that that happens. At the local level, the level of the international, it's about community resilience, it's about policing, law enforcement, and some intelligence. But as I've argued a number of times, we need to have an honest debate about how much of our freedom we're willing to give up in order to preserve security. I don't think that actually you can generate perfect security even if you do give up all of your freedoms. And in particular, I think we need to be really, really careful about demonizing migrants or members of Muslim minorities in Western countries, because in facing ISIS, we're dealing with an enemy whose specialty is provoking sectarian conflict, generating violence, and then using that to gain power. So anything that plays into that narrative really just strengthens ISIS and its ability to reach into our own societies.
Well, my last question would be going back to the Kurdish question in the Middle East. How do you see a prospect of an independent Kurdish state in that region?
I think we already have a de facto autonomous Kurdistan. It's not a unified state because it includes elements in Iraq and in Syria, but there certainly is the beginnings in Rojava and other places of the emergence of a fully autonomous state-like entity. I think that the Kurds have a lot of support from the international community, primarily because they've tended to be very defensive and tended to follow their own interests and not try to attack others. And I think that, their focus on economic development and on a secular democratic approach has really served the Kurds very well in the last 20 years of their de facto independence. I think the real question comes when you think about Turkey and how that relates to this new entity, and when you think about how the emergence of an autonomous Kurdistan might affect the chances for reconstruction and stabilization in Iraq and Syria. And so I think it's not without its problems, and it's certainly not a stabilizing effect that we're seeing from the emergence of de facto Kurdistan. But I think it's a fact on the ground, and people as we go forward need to be thinking about how to deal with those facts.
So does that mean Turkish fears of an independent Kurdish state are legitimate?
That's a different question, because I think Turks fear that an independent, fully autonomous Kurdistan might have territorial ambitions within Turkey, and they also fear that Turkish citizens of Kurdish ethnicity might be drawn toward that kind of independent state. You can very well understand why Turks might feel like that, because they've been confronting an insurgency with the PKK for a generation or more. But I think that any Kurd would recognize that we're not talking about a unified state. There are many different elements to it, many different political parties, many regional groupings. PKK is not the voice of in an independent Kurdistan. It's a plurality of voices. So I think that Turkish fears aren't illegitimate, but they're certainly not necessarily a prophecy of something that's going to come true. I think we need to recognize that Turkey's got an interest in its own territorial integrity, but Kurds also have an interest in national self-determination.
Well, Dr. David Kilcullen, we thank you so much for joining us here at SBS Radio. It's been a pleasure hearing all your insight.
Thank you for having me.
SBS Radio, Bashir Kurdine.